Hello and welcome to the Dyslexia Explored podcast. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I've got a guest with us who runs a reading coaching service, tutoring 2,000 people across multiple locations in America. She's grown up in the world of special education. Her mum was the founder of a special education school, taught children with dyslexia. She got a master's degree in special education, a doctorate in general education, and has been in the world of remediating reading and writing and special education for the last 20 plus years. So Dr. Emily Levy, it is great to have you with us here today.
It's great to be here. Thank you for the nice introduction.
I'm looking forward to hearing your take on some of the typical questions we ask our guests about their dyslexia story. Why don't we just go right back, and where I like to start it with guests is, what was life like before you knew about dyslexia, and what was your wake-up call to dyslexia? I think you might have a slightly different take on this than many of our guests. First of all, do you have dyslexia yourself?
I do not have dyslexia myself.
Okay, so your dyslexia story is not a story of your dyslexia journey, but of being alongside thousands of children with dyslexia in their journey. So where did you wake up to dyslexia? When and where, and what was the wake-up call?
Well, my story, as you said, I think is a little bit different than the typical story. I feel that dyslexia and dyslexia remediation is almost in my blood. I've been around it for so many years. My mother, whose brother has dyslexia, started a school for students with learning disabilities in South Florida. She then opened two smaller subsidiary schools in different parts of Florida. And I really spent my whole childhood working at her schools, both in the classroom, tutoring students, just being around students who had dyslexia and around the Orton-Gillingham method for so many years that I feel it's almost in my blood. With that said, in my journey, I felt that I wanted to initially experiment in other fields and actually did finance for about 2 years out of college, and then realized that dyslexia and dyslexia remediation was really my true passion and my true calling. So I then pivoted back to dyslexia. I began tutoring students myself for many years who had dyslexia along with other learning disabilities and ADHD, and then eventually formed EBL Coaching, where we have a wonderful team of learning specialists who specialize in providing one-on-one tutoring to students who have learning disabilities, including dyslexia, both virtually, really around the world, along with in-person at our learning centers.
Well, this might be a bit of a curveball, but you might have a good perspective on this, because my dad just fell and he's elderly. He was 82, walking up the Scottish Highlands, independent. He fell, hurt his back, and he's in hospital. I'm in hospital trying to help him, and I'm completely bewildered by how the whole thing works. And someone said to me recently, a friend of mine, he said, well, that experience you had with your dad in hospital, I feel the same way with my child who's just got a dyslexia diagnosis. I feel so bewildered, and I don't know how this all works, and it feels like a whole new landscape and so on. And it just crossed my mind that, do we ever stop and pause and explain to people who have got young children or teenagers the whole kind of general flow of life with dyslexia, where there's a commonality flowing through it? And you'll hear it through the podcast. There's a lot of commonality between different people's stories from childhood through the tweenage years, teenage years, youthful years, and then young adult and adulthood, that dyslexia affects you in different ways and often in predictable ways. I wonder, would you be able to say what you see as common patterns through a child's progression from early years through middle school and high school with dyslexia?
Absolutely. And first off, I'm sorry to hear about your father. I hope that he'll be okay.
Oh, he's great. He's doing well now. Yes.
Good.
We figured it out.
Good, good. That's tea. Well, really, I've witnessed so many students with dyslexia starting at a very young age and really all the way through adulthood. Typically, when children are very young, when they're first diagnosed with dyslexia or they're showing signs of maybe having dyslexia, they really struggle with early reading skills and early phonemic awareness skills. They struggle to learn the individual letters and their corresponding sounds. They struggle to blend sounds together to form words, both with reading and with spelling. So it really starts almost as a mechanical challenge. They struggle with the mechanics of reading and spelling. And then a lot of times, if those students receive proper remediation, particularly when they're young, particularly using a multisensory method like Orton-Gillingham, they often really crack the code and they're able to learn how to decode and code words. With that said, unfortunately, it doesn't end there. A lot of times as they progress through school and the writing and reading demands start to increase, then we start to see a lot of challenges with writing, for instance. Often they're very bright and they have fantastic ideas, but really struggle to organize those thoughts on paper, to use proper writing mechanics, to use proper spelling. That becomes a challenge. Many of them still struggle with reading fluency, which as a result affects their ability to comprehend information that they're reading. They're often very strong with auditory comprehension with someone else's reading, but if they spend so much time trying to decode a word, oftentimes it affects their reading comprehension skills. And again, as students progress through middle school into high school and they have to write research papers and they have to write more complex written pieces, they have to read more complex passages and books, their dyslexia sort of carries with them as they move through school. With that said, though, there are just different tools that we integrate and that we teach them to help them combat and address each of those obstacles that they encounter as they move through school and really through life.
Fantastic. Thank you for that practical sort of what's happening in the classroom understanding. Could you tell us a little bit about what you've observed from the child's experience of school, not necessarily of the reading, but how it affects them in the classroom with their teacher, with their peers at the different age grades? Well, why don't we just make it super clear for people? Tell me if you agree with this or how you might adjust it. But let's say 5 to 9 years old is the stage where you're learning to read. And then 9 to 12 is where you're really reading to learn. And then 12 to 14, you're really having to write a lot in terms of written presentations and compositions and so on. And you're in the sort of essay zone. And then 14 to 16, 17, you're in the exam zone. So you're not just writing an essay, you're writing an essay in timed conditions, a certain structure, etc. So if we demarcated it in age range, would you adjust those ages or adjust those stages in any particular way or add to them?
I think that's a pretty accurate description of the different phases that a child with dyslexia will go through. I think there are definitely some themes throughout. I think many children develop self-esteem challenges because school is so difficult for them that they feel defeated a lot. They feel that they'll never learn how to read. They'll never be able to write like their peers. So a lot of what we do is really building that self-esteem and showing them any growth that we see. If they're able to read a multisyllabic word that they weren't able to read a month ago, we show that to them. And we really try to empower them to see that all this work that they're putting in, and even though they're facing these challenges, they're making progress, and that's a real feat. So I think really building that self-esteem is something that we try to do because it is something that we've noticed for so many kids. Many of them also have anxiety about not being able to perform in school. So there are other challenges that sometimes do come along with these learning challenges that we try to build in when we work with students. But what I find is sort of a silver lining often is that many of these kids, because they have to work so hard and oftentimes so much harder than their peers to do well in school, it really sets them up with great life skills that they learn how to work hard and how when you do work hard, you see results. And that's such an important skill for them to be successful in life once they get through all of these challenging academic years.
Yes. Yeah. It's such a common theme that the effort it takes to overcome those obstacles builds this work ethic.
Absolutely.
That's fascinating. You've got the technical challenges of dyslexia. You've then got the esteem challenges and the anxiety challenges. but then the payoff is the hard work ethic that comes with it.
Yes.
Let's extend it just a little bit. And I've noticed this into adulthood. Like, my area of work at the moment is to help adults with dyslexia in the workplace using their Apple devices in particular. So how to use your iPhone and iPads to take notes and executive function skills, basically, yeah, using speech to text and mind mapping and Apple Notes and just creating a system that is externalized. But what I've noticed with these parents is that, going back to the hard work, often they have got so used to working harder and longer that sometimes you think, oh, I'll just work harder. And then sometimes you have to break that cycle and just say, well, actually, sometimes you need to work smarter and save yourself a ton of work at the evenings and weekends. So that's the downside. Sometimes it's like, oh, I'll just work harder. That's not always the answer. What have you observed with your students over the years? Because have you seen many of them progress? Do you keep in touch with them from when they were young? I mean, over 20 years with 2,000 students, you must have relationships continuing. What's been your experience with that?
Sure. I do stay in touch with them. And many parents reach out to me and let me know how their child's doing, where they're at sort of different points in life. And a lot of it for these children is finding the right career path. Many of them are very creative and very gifted and very bright, but they need to find the right career path that perhaps might involve a little less reading, writing as a main focus. Of course, every career integrates some of that, but a lot of it, I think, is really identifying the right career path for them. And also, there are so many, as I'm sure, so many tools now, so much technology that they can integrate so that they can work smarter and not just harder all the time, and ways to make their lives easier. So that's something, especially as kids get older, that we integrate a lot more of the technology to really help them. For instance, with writing, they don't always have to hand write every essay because that's very laborious and very challenging. They can integrate technology to help them with that skill so that they don't have to spend hours upon hours every night working on writing assignments.
Yes. What are your favorite tech tools at the moment? I mean, what would be your top 10 or whatever in terms of recommendations? Can you rattle a few off the top of your head?
Well, the two that I happen to love for writing are Kidspiration and Inspiration, which are great programs for mainly for writing, for helping students to brainstorm their ideas before they begin writing. And what they're able to do is create these wonderful webs. They can integrate pictures and different graphics along with words to sort of lay out the framework for how they're going to then write their paragraph or essay. It's also great for pulling out information when reading to help with reading comprehension skills and to help them to become a more active reader, where they can read a passage and then pull out, for instance, the main idea and the topic and the details and create this web with all of that information organized in a very sound way. There's lots of dictation software programs available also so that students don't always have to write out their essays. Spellcheck is, of course, incredibly useful for individuals who have dyslexia and struggle with spelling. So those are just some examples of some of the tech tools.
Fantastic. Well, you're so American when you say web. In the UK, we stick to mind mapping because it was Tony Buzan who invented the mind mapping technique. And for those of you who are listening from the UK, Dr. Emily Levy is describing mind mapping in the Inspiration software, which is really a great tool. Unfortunately, the Inspiration software has stopped being updated. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. It's such a shame because it's a wonderful program.
Yeah. So they've stopped doing the updates and it will be discontinued quite soon. But there are other softwares out there. But unfortunately, one of the things that Inspiration software does very well is that ability to rearrange keywords and cluster them and start to sort of organize your paragraph. I mean, iThoughts and MindView are some decent comparable softwares, but they're not quite as child-friendly. They're more adult-based. Did you know that my company for children is all about mind mapping and executive function skills?
I did not know that. Great mind, freak alike.
Yeah. So you weren't a plant. So yeah, tell us a little bit about some of the publications you've done over the years and your motivation behind them. You told me that you've done Strategies for Study Success, your first book. What? When did you do that? What motivated you?
Sure. Well, I started writing that book series. There's 15 books in the series. It's a series of student workbooks that are consumable. And I began writing those, I believe, in 2004. And the reason why I did was I felt that I couldn't find resources for students to practice expository writing, to practice note-taking, to practice summarizing skills, test-taking skills that were very easy to follow, very organized, and gave students a lot of practice and repetition with each skill. And that's really what drew me into creating this book series, was just because I couldn't find anything out there that I felt really useful for our students. So I really designed it for that particular reason. We have specifically, there's a three-part expository writing program within Strategies for Study Success, which I love for helping students to develop their writing skills. It starts at the level of the simple paragraph, which is made of a topic sentence, three detail sentences, and a conclusion sentence. We go into teaching students how to start by brainstorming and then writing and then how to go back and self-check their work. We go into learning how to write four different types of paragraphs, the example paragraph, the process paragraph, the reason, the compare contrast, and then give students lots of practice and repetition writing each one of those types. And then later we go into the extended paragraph where students learn how to expand upon their writing. And that then sets the stage for the five paragraph essay, which of course so many students have difficulty with. So this really breaks it down. Also part of the Strategies for Study Success series is our highlighting program, where we teach students how to become active readers. They learn how to read different passages and then highlight the topic in blue, the main idea in green. And then they go through and learn how to identify salient, important details and highlight those in yellow, and then how to create written summaries from that information. So those are just some examples of some of the books within the Strategies for Study Success program. But the idea is every book gives students lots of practice and lots of repetition in order to really grasp and ideally master each of those individual skills.
Gosh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. How do people get that program? Do you just buy it on Amazon or something?
Either on Amazon or on our website.
Or your website.
Bellcoaching.com.
Okay, I'll put the link in the description below. Just swipe up anyone who's listening and you'll see the link to that. That's fascinating because I do a similar thing, not as complex and as detailed as that, with my Bullet Map Academy students with mind mapping. Do you include mind mapping as part of the, or webbing as part of the brainstorming process in that writing process?
Absolutely. That's really the essence of the brainstorming segment, is
fantastic,
creating that mind map. And we really break down the process. So the simple paragraph is much simpler than the extended paragraph in terms of the mind map. And then we teach students how to expand upon that mind map in order to write more complex paragraphs. So the answer is yes, absolutely. We integrate a lot of mind mapping.
Fascinating. And have you ever thought of making this into a video course or anything like that? Is it at that stage yet, or is it all in book form?
Right now, it's all in book form, but I have thought about creating video applications for it as well. So that's
fantastic.
Definitely in my pipeline.
Oh, that would be really, that would be really interesting. I mean, it's obviously what I do, but it's actually what I've been doing over the last 5 years is creating video courses to do that. I don't do the book because I'm dyslexic. I just can't get my head around the book, but I can get my head around practically teaching and describing the video editing and stuff like that. And now I'm more focused in on dyslexia for the parents, really, in the workplace. So it would be really lovely to see mind mapping in a structured way start develop, because there's very few online courses that teach mind mapping in a structured way for children with dyslexia. I was compelled to do it for my 14-year-old 6-7 years ago, but I was just shocked that something that is used so commonly in the workplace, brainstorming with a web or a mind map, is so common to brainstorm ideas, structure them, and then turn them into something useful, that I've noticed that in schools, it's just not taught in a structured way. Often it's just this kind of, I don't know, have you ever noticed this in your experience, if you've been teaching a bit of mind mapping. It's fascinating to speak to someone who has. So forgive me for going down this rabbit hole.
Oh,
because
okay.
When I spoke to someone who had been taught by Tony Buzan, the inventor of mind mapping, you go away for a day as an executive and you spend £3,000 for a 6-hour workshop with Tony Buzan. I said, what was it about the mind mapping teaching from Tony Buzan that really made you wake up to mind mapping? He said, well, mind mapping made me create and add lots more ideas and just brought creativity. And then I realized at that point why my way of teaching mind mapping was so different from most people's experience of learning mind mapping with dyslexia, because most people with dyslexia don't need any more creativity or any more added ideas. They actually need to go the other way, is to have the ideas and bring focus to it and distill it. So there's some people who need to start from the center and create lots more ideas and generate ideas, and other people who start from generating ideas and need to bring it into focus. Mm. And I just wondered, what's been your experience of teaching children with dyslexia to mind map in this way? What's been your experience?
Well, it's very interesting because, like you said, children with dyslexia typically have so many wonderful ideas. They're so creative. But when it comes to sitting down to write, they don't know where to begin. They don't know how to formulate well-written sentences. So oftentimes they just write the absolute minimum that they need to so that they can be done and bond, or they resist it, or they have anxiety of surrounding writing. So what I find mind mapping or webbing really helps with is to help them create some organization to these wonderful ideas that they have. So rather than just sitting down and starting to write and freezing and not knowing where to begin, we start by teaching them how to take these great ideas and create more of a sort of a systematic approach for how to lay out those ideas. And then once they've done that, it's so much easier for them to then take that information and translate it into written form. And it's
absolutely
really eye-opening to see what a difference it makes for them when they use this approach.
Yes, yes. And when you get them to do webbing, do you get them to do it by hand, by drawing it out by hand and coloring it? Or do you get them to do it on inspiration or a computer or both?
It depends on the child. Some have a preference for one or the other. Sometimes we'll use both, but usually it's one or the other, just depending on what works best for that child.
Great, great. And do you do that as part of your coaching program, or is that just your publication that people just pick up and use?
Oh, we absolutely do it as part of our coaching program, particularly with writing. Without a doubt, it's a very big part of what we do. We also use that mind mapping, webbing approach for teaching students how to take notes in class when they're older. Many of those kids really don't know how to start when it comes to taking notes. So that's another angle that we use for teaching them webbing. But absolutely, we definitely integrate this into our coaching.
Brilliant. Fascinating. I didn't even know this, that that was part of your program. So it's just so lovely to have you on the program to talk about this. Absolutely brilliant. This podcast is sponsored by DyslexiaProductivityCoaching.com, which helps you organize yourself creatively with a productivity system for Apple devices. Let's talk about doodles then. Okay, so if you're teaching children how to mind map and you're teaching them to web, how much do you teach your children to doodle or draw and sketch and so on as part of this process of note-taking? Because one of my next questions would be, have you managed to get the children to get to the point of being able to mind map while they're listening to something live in simultaneously? Because that can be quite a challenge for anyone who's learned how to mind map, especially children with dyslexia who are scared of missing the important topic and expect to write absolutely everything that's said, and all that kind of jazz is what they're built up to. But then when it comes to mind mapping, they have to think about the salient key ideas and the key words and structure it. And that's a revelation and inspiration for them to simplify. But it can be quite hard to get to that stage. What's been your experience of getting them to that stage of note taking?
Well, you're right. I think that's a challenge for many students, not just students who have dyslexia. And it's funny, sometimes I ask our 6th or 7th graders how they feel about their note taking skills. And a lot of them say, it's great. I just copy everything off the board. But then, of course, as they get older and they have to really listen and take notes, that's where the challenge sets in. So what we do in those scenarios is that we really encourage them to use symbols, abbreviations, contractions, so that they're not trying to get down every single word and as a result really miss out on what they're listening to. So it's, and we'll actually even do separate lessons on how to create symbols, abbreviations, and contractions before they even begin taking notes.
Oh, fantastic.
So that they know how to do that. And drawing is something we integrate as well, as long as the students are not spending too much time trying to create a perfect drawing or a perfect design, but using it more as a tool to help them get notes down in a more efficient manner.
Yes, and that's, I make the distinction between drawing and doodling for that particular reason. Like I do this three-line game. Have you ever played a three-line game? It's a fun little game where you're allowed to draw three straight lines, okay? And the person tries to guess what you've drawn. And then you draw another, if they guess it wrong, you get another three lines. And then you see how few lines you can use to communicate the thing you're drawing, like a cow or a sun or whatever it is. It's like Pictionary, but you've just got three lines. And the beauty of it is that it disciplines you to realize that with just a few visual shorthand strokes and so on, you can create a doodle or a symbol or an icon that doesn't require you to spend 30 seconds or a minute drawing that whole thing out. What's been your experience of transitioning kids from, because often highly visual kids, which is often comes with dyslexia, is they're drawing quite detailed drawings and so on, and they can get carried away and locked into that. How do you transition them away from that to the simplified doodling?
Well, a lot of it comes down to explicit instruction. So that's why we'll do these mini units on what does it mean to create a symbol? What does it mean to create a doodle or drawing for the purpose of taking notes, not for the purpose of creating an artistic masterpiece, which many of them are able to do separately, but really for the purpose of taking notes. So we really try to be explicit with what our goal is, what are we trying to teach them, and then do mini lessons on that before translating it into a note-taking setting. And then a lot of times what we'll do is we'll simulate a lecture or simulate a situation where a teacher might be presenting a lecture and the student needs to take notes on that before they even go into the classroom and try to practice that method.
That's fantastic. That's excellent. I mean, it's like, how long have you been doing that for? How long have you been doing this process for?
This particular, notating, mind mapping, almost 20 years now, for a long time.
Fantastic. Yeah. I've been doing it for 5, and I feel, my goodness, this is fantastic. Do you know what? It's interesting. I meet so many people through Facebook, podcasts, and so on. They're like, Darius, there's no one who's doing this, what you're doing, which I'm doing exactly what you're doing. Do you know what I mean? I'm doing exactly what you're doing, but I have to see this. This is fantastic. Anyway, we got to move on. Your next book, let's see what hidden treasure is in your next book. So number 2, The Flags and Stars, Orton Gillingham. What's that? Have I got that right?
You did. You did get that right. So the Flags and Stars, Orton Gillingham program is also a multi-part student workbook series that's specific to the Orton-Gillingham methodology and specific to helping students to develop their decoding and encoding skills, or really their reading and their spelling skills. It's very systematic. It's very multisensory. We integrate all of the kinesthetic, the tactile, the visual, the auditory modalities when teaching students essentially how to read. And really what that program does is it begins with consonants and short vowels. So really making sure students have an understanding of the names of each letter along with their corresponding sound, including the short vowel. And then we work on how to blend those sounds together to form words. We use magnetic tiles. We use whiteboards. We use lots of different tools, shaving cream, colored sand. So the kids actually really enjoy it. It's a lot of fun for them, but it's also very much part of this structured and systematic approach. And then we move on to more complex word patterns, including words that have blends, words that have consonant digraphs and vowel digraphs, silent E patterns, multisyllabic words, prefixes, suffixes, and roots, and so on. So really starting with the foundations and then really building upwards from there.
I had a guest on the podcast recently, and she was very similar sounding. She's from a company called Ebley. Instead of EBL, it would be Ebley. I don't know if you've heard of it.
So
no. So what she was proposing was the approach to reading where you go from speech to text rather than text to speech. I don't know if you've heard of this kind of difference in initially teaching children how to read. And I don't just mean special education teaching, but teaching as a whole. Have you heard of that?
I've heard a little bit about it. I'm not an expert in it, but I have heard about it.
Okay. Right. Well, maybe what I was fascinated about with this was she was saying that, and I'm not an expert in this either. If you want to know more, listen to the last podcast where there'll be listeners. But this idea that instead of getting a child to look at a printed word and then say it out, which is text to speaking it out, you take a word that they know, like baby. I'm taking out the, I don't know what words they would start, but baby. Oh, I can say baby. And then you put it into text by chunking it down into how many sounds do you hear there? What sounds do you hear? Ah, buh, this is how you would draw buh, etc. Have you got any thoughts on that, or should we move on to something else?
I could give some thoughts. Again, I'm not an expert, but my thoughts on that is if you go from speech to text, while it may work for some students, I think now when it comes to that text component, we're now bringing in all these complex word patterns and sounds that may be too advanced for that child to be introduced to if they haven't quite grasped the basics. So I'm more of a believer of that traditional structured approach of let's start with the basics. Let's make sure the foundations are there before we move into more complex patterns. I think it may, for some kids, create confusion if we're bringing in words that have these complex patterns when they haven't quite mastered the basics. That's just my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I'm asking this question for a friend.
Okay.
Literally, actually, I live in the world of what you've just described, the teenage 10 to 16 year old study skills in school, middle school and high school, and then adult workplace assistance. So I'm not really educationally aware about the early years of reading, teaching reading. What's it like for parents, in your observation, entering into this world of, well, my child's got dyslexia. I think I'll just leave it to the school. They're the experts. And then, oh gosh, it's still not working. And then where do I go? Dr. Emily Levy says this, and Dr. such and such says we should do it that way. And then you get into this world where there seems like lots of options or lots of voices. What's your advice to a parent experiencing that right now?
Well, first off, I think it's really important for parents to always be an advocate for their child and not to just rely on school or assume that school is providing the right kind of instruction. Because too many times I hear stories where parents assumed that the school was addressing these challenges in the right way, only to find a year later that they weren't getting what they should have been receiving or didn't receive the right type of instruction. And now we have to go back and play catch up on really what they missed. So I definitely feel parents always have to be an advocate for their child and really have an understanding of what is the school providing? Is there anything I should do outside of school to further support my child so that we don't miss any of these precious years? So I think that's really key component. Tell me the second part of your question.
Still asking for a friend. Sometimes it can feel like, okay, my friend feels in this situation as a parent that starting to advocate for your child might be undermining your relationship with the school. It might, they're maybe used to respecting authorities, respecting doctors, respecting teachers, respecting people who are professionals in that field, but then coming in and starting to question what they're doing. Are you doing what's right for my child? Are you doing X, Y, and Z, and so on? What about that? How do they deal with that? Because sometimes you don't want to be that parent that is
correct,
just criticizing everything and everyone, and then people just switch off to you, and maybe you alienate your relationship with the teacher or the head teacher, and you want to have a constructive relationship with the school. How do you navigate all of that? What's been your experience or advice?
Sure. Well, I do think it's important not to undermine school or to question them in any kind of derogatory kind of way, but to really approach it as more of let's work as a team. We know that you have my child's best interest in mind. I have my child's best interest in mind. Let's just make sure we're doing this together. What is there anything I can do outside of school to help support what you are doing? Is there any supplemental work that my child can do at home? Can we check in every few months and just see how things are going so that we don't have to wait until parent-teacher conferences or until grades come out to know how my child's doing? So I think really taking more of that team approach and going into it as though I appreciate everything that you're doing, but what else can we do as a team to make sure that we don't lose any time and we're all doing what's right for my child?
Oh, I like that. I like how you've emphasized shortening this feedback loop. So the feedback loop isn't every 6 months or 4 months or every year, depending on your rhythm of your feedback with the teacher, but it becomes every couple of months rather than every year or every 6 months. And that feedback loop can catch things that are slipping a bit, can't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think if it's approached in the right way, the teachers won't find it to be an annoyance or a pain, but more of a way of just communicating so that everyone's on the same page and everyone's doing what's best for this child.
Okay, I've got another gnarly question for a friend. This is quite funny. I don't normally do this, but because it's so living with me. And what if you go to a school which prides itself on its special education assistive programs, maybe a private school? Oh, we've got that covered. We know about dyslexia and so on. Don't worry about it. Just leave it with us. And the child's reading isn't developing. It becomes another awkward situation where you're kind of like, oh, it's different if they don't have the special ed program because, oh, what can we do to supplement it? And they go, great. Yeah, you could supplement it with X, Y, and Z. But if they feel like they've got a program that they can supplement it in within school, how do you deal with that situation?
Sure. I do think it's different when a child attends a special ed school. And first off,
isn't a special ed school.
Oh, it's not a special.
This is a private school that has a special education department, like every school does. Yes. But they kind of pride themselves in it a bit better than the standard special education department. But it's not special ed school at all.
Got it. Okay. So my first reaction to that is I would call a meeting with the teacher who was ever providing any extra remediation at school and really try to understand what they've been working on and why perhaps that isn't working. Why are we not seeing progress? Maybe there's something else going on. Maybe there's a focusing issue. Maybe there's a behavior issue. Maybe there's some other piece that's going on that hasn't quite been addressed. Maybe they have another method that they can try. If this particular method isn't working, do you have other resources that we can try? Try to feel that out. There are some scenarios where I've seen, even when kids are at an excellent private school that has excellent learning support specialists, sometimes it's just not enough. And parents do need to look into the possibility of a more specialized special ed school where this kind of instruction is integrated throughout the day and not just during pull-out sessions or just during parts of the day.
Okay, great. So, let's talk a bit about executive function. I've noticed a lot of listeners, they've heard of dyslexia, they've heard of ADHD, they've heard of special education, but then when you use the word executive function, they're like, oh, I don't know what that is. And there's so many words thrown out within the world of special education, is it relevant? Isn't it? Now, you and I both know executive function is a big deal. How would you characterize executive function within the world of dyslexia, ADHD, special education, et cetera?
Sure. Well, actually, two of my books in the Strategies for Study Success series are on executive functioning. So it is a big part of what we do in our coaching and in my life as well. And many students who have dyslexia and or ADHD also struggle with executive functioning. And really what that means is they have difficulty with skills like planning, organization, time management, task initiation, getting started with their homework. And they really just struggle with all of those skills or some of those skills, which can affect really almost every aspect of school and life. So what we find to be really effective is teaching them concrete strategies for how to build those individual skills and then how to apply them strategies to school or to life. So for example, one strategy that we work on for building time management skills, which is an aspect of executive functioning, is we teach students to estimate how long they think a task might take to complete and then compare it to the actual time it takes to complete. So for example, let's say they have a math worksheet that they need to do. We might ask them, well, how long do you think it's going to take to complete this math worksheet? And they might say 10 minutes. So we'd write down each year estimated time is 10 minutes. And then they go ahead and they do the math worksheet and we take a look at how long it actually took. And what we find is that for students who have issues or challenges with time management, there's usually a big discrepancy between those two times in the beginning. But as we practice that skill and we draw awareness to it, it really starts to become more realistic with their time. And in turn, it really starts to build their time management skills.
Yes. And I love that. And I wanted to ask you that because it's a big deal in my life right now. I've actually got another podcast that I do called the Personal Brain Trainer Podcast with Dr. Erica Warren, where we talk about executive function skills. And I've seen this even go into the workplace. So like you could be a very successful surveyor, for example, and you go and do a survey on a property and it's crucial that you have the right judgment about the valuation of the property and connecting the right people to the right property. And there's a whole suite of soft skills and people skills that are important in that, and analysis skills and so on, that are so natural for people with dyslexia. But then you got to write the report and it's 10 pages long and has 30 sections in it and so on. And you think to yourself, oh, it takes 8 hours to write this report. And I've got clients who are like, yeah, it takes me 8 hours to do this report, but I'm finding it's taking me a bit longer. And I say, well, how much longer do you think? Well, maybe about 12 hours. And I say, well, let's go through the report and see, mark it up. And they're like, oh my goodness, it's taking me 16, maybe 17 hours when it should have taken 8 for a typical. And so that's an executive function challenge. Mm-hmm. And often people think, oh, well, that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd love to hear you talk to that. I mean, obviously, as a child, you see it happen with math. And then in the workplace, you start seeing it happen with reports and other things. And it's interesting, though, actually, as you get older, the stakes get higher.
Yeah.
And actually, it's interesting. I've noticed you can get away with executive function skills in your early 20s if you're really hardworking and good at what you do. People just go, all right, yeah, Darius really works hard, really great at doing those kind of sales or reports or whatever, making those connections, doing those deals, etc. Oh, he's a bit late on some of his deadlines, but he gets the job done. That's the important thing. I can trust him to get it done. But then in 30s, you hit this sort of threshold where if you don't get it done at the right time or you don't do X, Y, and Z, it starts coming back on you professionally. And people go, do they really care? Are they really valuing me, etc.? And they're reading the wrong message because something delayed isn't an act of disrespect. It's actually an expression of dyslexia compounded by executive function skills. So what have you seen really change a child's executive function skills? There's a calibration of estimated to actual. Anything else you can see helping that into the workplace?
Absolutely. Well, I think that the earlier a child can learn strategies for building stronger executive functioning skills, clearly the better that it'll be and the easier it'll be for them as they move through school. So I think really being proactive as early on as possible is key. With that said, I think even for adults who we work with, we really try to teach them to take more of a systematic and organized approach when they need to complete tasks like writing a report like that. Meaning, for instance, instead of just starting and delving in and starting to write and gather your ideas, let's begin by brainstorming, just like we do with students who are younger. Let's try to really map out and have an understanding of what this report's going to look like. How am I going to start? What are my main points going to be that I want to address? How am I going to conclude this so that I have really more of an organized plan before I begin writing? Then we go ahead and work on writing a first draft and create sort of a self-editing checklist, which for many of our younger students, we use one that's called COPS as an example, which stands for capitalization, organization, punctuation, and spelling, where we teach them to go back and individually self-check for each of those elements on the checklist. However, as students get older and for adult individuals, we find that sometimes they have to create their own individualized checklist, meaning if they really feel that they have a hard time with grammar or with using proper punctuation when it comes to starting and ending sentences or whatever it may be, we add their own individualized elements to their checklist so that they know what to go back and look for when they're self-checking their work.
Love it. Yes. Yes. Wild card question here is artificial intelligence. Okay. Have you had any experience with ChatGPT or any other AI assistive reading like WordTune or, I mean, Grammarly is a basic version of it, but using artificial intelligence with dyslexia and special education, have you got any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't have any direct experience with it. I certainly know about it. I've listened to podcasts about it. I think it's an interesting concept. I think right now there is a concern that it would just sort of take away from really learning how to learn, learning how to read, learning how to write, and using this as a tool in lieu of that. But I think at some point in the future, if there could be some combination of both, I think that may be a great solution for individuals with dyslexia.
Yeah, I've been experimenting with all of those. Quite frankly, I'm infatuated with artificial intelligence, and I think somehow it's going to be really a critical step for people with dyslexia. Just like typing with a computer was a critical step for people with dyslexia. A lot of people really appreciated the speed of touch typing, how mind mapping programs like Inspiration were really helpful with dyslexia. Then spell check was really helpful. Now we've got grammar check. And then speech to text is a form of machine learning. Text to speech is a form of machine learning. Have you come across WordTune by any chance?
That one I have not.
So it's an Israeli company who created their own machine learning program called WordTune. And I've been using it. And a number of other specialists have started using it since I've shared it on the podcast. But what's interesting is you type a sentence, okay? And then you click WordTune, which is a bubble beside your sentence, and it drops down six other variations of that sentence. So it's not writing the whole document or the paragraph or whatever. It just shows you six different ways that people might say exactly the same thing. And so you look at it and you go, gosh, that is a beautiful way of saying it. Like, instead of, you might have a childish way of saying something, walking down the sea, I wanted to go see the cat. And then the dolphin. You might rephrase that and say, I really wanted to go and see the cat and the dolphin down by the sea. You're changing the focus of it rather than this sort of, oh, I'm describing everything and then I'm getting to the point. But you get that instant feedback of other different options. And it's a bit like a variation of spell check, but on a macro level, you see the spelling, you go, how is that wrong? And you click on it and you, oh, I get you. That's how it is. And you do that a couple of hundred times and you might actually learn the spelling. And the same with the writing of the sentences. Have you ever experimented with anything like that with students?
Well, I haven't used that program in particular. I think it's a great idea. And I think the more we can expose students to other ways of writing well-written sentences, other options, the better. My only potential concern would be that it doesn't flow properly. For instance, when you use Google Translate, it doesn't always translate properly. So I think it's just important that you'll still keep an eye on the whole paragraph or the whole picture to make sure it really fits in properly.
Yes, yes. Yeah, fascinating. So is there anything you'd like to talk about, anything that's particularly on your mind within the world of dyslexia and coaching and tutoring and some sort of learnings that you've made recently over the last couple of years, maybe COVID or remote work learning and all of that jazz? Is there anything that you've that's current? Sure.
Yeah, I'll tell you a few things. One is I always find it interesting when we do work with adults and I listen to their stories and I hear about who they are and how they've reached their point in life. And so many of them tell me that they wish that they had received remediation when they were younger. They wish that dyslexia was more acknowledged and that they were options for how to build the skills that they struggled with, because so many just felt like they were failures in school. So I think it's really a gift that we have so much research now. We have so many tools that we can use to teach children at a young age to really push through and build skills through each of these obstacles they may encounter in school. And I think there's so many gifts that we've really been able to identify and to now pass on to our children that many adults just never had when they were kids. In terms of COVID, it's really been an interesting evolution from our work perspective. Before COVID, we really were doing everything in person, all of the remediation. And then when everything shut down, we sort of had no choice but to jump online and provide virtual tutoring, because these kids who have dyslexia and other learning disabilities really couldn't go without anything. So many of them needed the support. So we quickly created a lot of electronic resources, found electronic resources that already existed, and started to really develop this one-on-one virtual. And what we found even now is that, first off, one-on-one coaching is very different than I think the experience many of these kids had in a classroom setting, tried to do virtual learning. I think it was a disaster for many of them. I think, first off, the technology really didn't exist and everyone was trying to figure it out on the go. And there were so many kids on this virtual classroom. But on a one-on-one basis, we really identified ways and we've integrated tools so that we can engage with the kids almost as though we were in person working side by side with them, which has really given us the opportunity to help so many kids, not just in our New York area, but really around the country and around the world who may not have access to Orton-Gillingham instruction or to this kind of remediation on a one-on-one in-person basis. So it's really been a wonderful new tool that we've been able to add since COVID.
Are most of your centers in the New York area?
Yes. The in-person ones are all in New York area and New Jersey.
How many do you have?
We have 3 centers, and then we do one-on-one work at students' homes in all of the boroughs surrounding in New York City and then all of northern New Jersey.
Okay. Do you do assessments as well, or does someone else do that?
I do the assessments. That's my main role.
Okay. How many assessments do you do in a year?
Well, that's a good question. A lot. I would say somewhere between, 300 to 400 in a given year.
That's a lot of assessments.
It's a lot of assessments, but I really enjoy it. It's not an assessment for the purpose of diagnosing dyslexia. It's not a neuropsychological evaluation.
Oh, it's not a neuropsych assessment.
No, I'm not a neuropsychologist, so that's not what I do. It's more for the purpose of really kind of identifying the strengths and weaknesses, the academic levels of the student, and the best plan of action from an instructional standpoint that I'd recommend for that student.
So that's nearly one a day. That is one a day. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work. Let's go back to your comments about, going back to adults and them reflecting back on their childhood and wishing they had it and so on. What's your take on dyslexia being inherited and being passed down through generations and the dynamic between parents and children there?
Well, there's definitely a genetic component. There are many, many parents that I meet with whose child has dyslexia also. And in fact, as I think you alluded to earlier, many parents really start to think about the fact that they likely have dyslexia because they see the struggles that their child is going through. And then it becomes sort of this self-reflection process, because most of these evaluations didn't exist and really weren't done when the parents were children and when they were in school. So it really becomes this point of self-reflection, of identifying their own challenges when they were a child.
Have you read the book Dyslexic Advantage?
No, I have not.
By Dr. Brock. Oh, it's here. Well, the second edition is coming out in February. I'm going to interview the Dr. Eads. It's just an incredible transformation, I think, the Dyslexic Advantage has created within the mindset of society towards thinking that dyslexia is not a disadvantage, it's a trade-off, that you have some difficulties in certain areas because other areas have been enhanced. So there's this sort of mental trade-off. What's your take on that sort of concept in your experience?
Well, I think I do see a lot of that. I think many children who have dyslexia really struggle with the mechanics of reading and writing, but have so many gifts socially, intellectually, from a creative standpoint that often surpass many of their peers who do well in school academically. So I do think there is some sort of trade-off. And I think it's a matter of How do we build upon those areas that are weaker, but capitalize upon those areas of strength, particularly when it comes to future career life?
Yeah. Well, it has been fantastic speaking to you, Emily. Are there any final words you'd like to say to those listening, maybe resources you'd like to direct them to, et cetera?
Thank you. I've actually written a lot of different articles about dyslexia, about ways to help improve your child's reading skills, writing skills, math skills, ways to make reading more fun. So if anyone's interested in reading any of those articles, learning more, they're welcome to go to our website, which is ablcoaching.com. There's lots of resources there.
Great. And if you swipe up, all these links will be there that you can just click on and go straight to just now.
Beautiful.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Emily Levy. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. It's been wonderful.
Great. Until next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com. It's my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. Tell me, do you know what you want to achieve in the workplace, but you're struggling with how to achieve it? Maybe you suspect some traits of dyslexia are getting in the way. Well, that's where Dyslexia Productivity Coaching comes in, because we give you a simple productivity system for your Apple devices that harnesses the creativity that comes with your dyslexia. It includes proven methods like note-taking, reminders, speech-to-text, mind mapping, and more, all tailored to your needs. It'll free up your time and help you achieve outstanding results. Book a complimentary call to discuss it with me, and if you do it soon, I may also be available to coach you personally via Zoom. So don't be shy, go to dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com or swipe up and book it now.